drummer Alvin Queen and his quintet with There's Blues Everywhere, an appropriate title for our program today. It's from his 2006 album, I Ain't Looking at You. I love that. I Ain't Looking at You as a title for an album. Jesse Davis on alto sax, Terrell Stafford on trumpet and flugelhorn, Mike Ledon on Hammond B3, and Peter Bernstein on guitar. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we have the pleasure of wonderful company today in the person of Dr. Gerald Horn, the political scientist and historian who is with us to help us understand a bit better, or even for the first time, several developments around the world and at home that have serious implications for U.S. domestic and foreign policy. As you know, Dr. Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. A prolific author, he has written more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. His most recent book is The Rise and Fall of the Associated Negro Press, Claude Barnett's Pan-African News and the Jim Crow Paradox. You know, he regularly favors us with his company and his insights on social, complex social, political, and economic issues right here on Lead Stories, and he is with us today. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, I like to start always. I know this is your most recent book, but I suspect that you already are on another book. What will it be?
Well, actually, after the Negro Press book came out in August, I dropped a book on Black people in aviation in September. But I'm really excited about the ones that will come out in January. That is to say, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in the 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. It's trying to integrate the history of the Caribbean with the history of North America, while telling this broader story, as the title suggests, about the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism, how we got to Donald J. Trump, which is lurking in the background of this entire narrative. And I have to say, I'm very excited about that book. And then I have another book coming out in January, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, which is about this remarkable story of pro-Tokyo black people in North America before Hiroshima and Nagasaki being bombed atomically by the U.S. in August 1945, and all of those folks being rolled up and jailed, quite frankly, although they were anticipating a Japanese invasion of North America that they planned to join. So I'm very excited, I have to say, about those books, which is not to say I'm not excited about the two that just dropped.
Okay, I am excited about that because, you know, the Black Press is very close to my heart, and I would really like to arrange a lecture by you on the book and follow-up questions from the audience. This is one of the things that the audience really appreciates, the closer contact that they have on the program with you and other guests allows them to ask questions that I don't ask. So we'll do some of that today too, hoping that we have enough time because there's so much to talk about.
Really?
Where do you want to start?
Zimbabwe.
Ah, I suspected so. Well, Zimbabwe, of course, has experienced a very momentous shift in leadership, with President Robert Mugabe, as of yesterday, agreeing to resign under the pressure of impeachment and under the pressure of a popular call for him to step down. How do you read the situation now?
Well, first of all, You know that I lived in Zimbabwe some years ago, published a book from the barrel of a gun about the U.S. role during the Liberation War, 1965 to 1980, which was, of course, published in Zimbabwe itself and, in fact, is sold all over the country. To get right to the current moment, the heir apparent to the throne, if you like, in Zimbabwe, replacing longtime President Robert Gabriel Mugabe, I'm speaking of Emmerson Mnangagwa, I listened to his speech just today when he arrived in Zimbabwe after fleeing the country after he had been sacked by Mr. Mugabe. And you all know about the succeeding events, which I will not go over unless you insist that I do. But in any case, I have to say his speech was not very conciliatory today. That is to say that he spoke, perhaps understandably, in contemptuous terms about what he called an attempt to poison him in August that led to him being airlifted to being hospitalized in South Africa. He was very contemptuous of what he called the, quote, cabal, unquote, surrounding President Robert Mugabe. And there were not any overtones of reconciliation, I'm afraid to say. Now, he will be speaking again on Friday at a more formal setting, and perhaps some will pull his coat, and or perhaps he'll have a change of heart. Who knows? But that was a rather unsettling sign because there is a very fluid situation in Zimbabwe right now, needless to say, when you have a leader of 37 years disposed and dispatched in a matter of days. And there's a lot of hunger for score settling, I'm afraid to say. And that presents a very dangerous backdrop. And in any case, the ruling party, I would say, is on the back foot, having lost a certain amount of credibility since 9 or 10 days ago. They were unanimous in their support for Robert Mugabe, and just this week they were unanimous, virtually unanimous, I should say, in their attempt to dislodge him. And this may prepare the backdrop for some sort of reconciliation with the North Atlantic powers, particularly if you're not going to reconcile internally. That is to say, reconciliation with Washington, whose sanctions slapped on Zimbabwe, along with Australia in particular, I might add, in a remarkable display of settler colonial solidarity, helped to create an economy that was screaming, subject to hyper world-class inflation, and serving as the precursor, if you like, to this remarkable change of government. A future scholar might look at this whole episode through the lens of gender. What I mean is that much focus has been directed towards the president's spouse, Grace Mugabe, 41 years younger, who it was said had presidential ambitions all of her own after starting off as a traditional first lady, that is to say, cutting ribbons and all the rest. And as a person who lived in Zimbabwe, I have to say that one of the most remarkable aspects of that vibrant society featuring some of the highest literacy rates on planet Earth, the South African economy would probably collapse, but for the energy of Zimbabwe exiles. But what struck me was the fact that oftentimes when a husband would die, the relatives of that deceased man would come into the house and oftentimes put the wife, the widow, on the streets, literally, and claim all of the property. And I'm not sure Grace Mugabe will be doing an oral history or interviews, given how she's being scorned right now. But I think it's reasonable to infer that at a certain point, given the fact that Mr. Mugabe is 93 years old, she might have been wondering about what her status would be and what the status of her children would be in a post-Robert Mugabe Zimbabwe, and that might have helped to spur on her presidential ambition. Secondly, I think that there might have been a false signal sent by the reaction to the purging from leadership a few years ago of Joyce Mujuru, who also was a vice president, who was sent packing. But what's striking is that the military, which has put forward this notion that you cannot begin to think about serving as the top leader of Zimbabwe unless you have liberation movement credentials, which basically rules out anybody under 60, since the liberation war concluded with independence in 1980, that's constructing a de facto gerontocracy, so to speak,
being very unkind.
Well, no, it's the rule of the old, the more gray hair I get in my head, the more sympathetic I become to gerontocracy. I must confess. But having said that, Joyce Mujuru had probably a more sterling combat career during the war than even Mugabe or Mnangagwa, but yet when she was sacked, the military did not stir, which may have sent a false signal to what is now being referred to as the Mugabe cabal by the heir apparent, that they could then move against other leaders to clear the path for Grace Mugabe. But probably a gender-sensitive scholar might conclude that there's one standard for moving against women who had earned their stripes during the Liberation War, but another standard for moving against a man like Emerson and Mnangagwa. But I'll leave that to future historians. Then there's the question of solidarity. You might recall that when South African President Thabo Mbeki was sacked a few years ago, one of the charges against him was that he was not sufficiently energetic in helping to push Mugabe out of power. Now, I hope and I trust, although if you listen carefully to the speech given today by Mnangagwa, you might come to the conclusion that South Africa was winning with regard to this coup that wasn't a coup, that was just executed in Zimbabwe. If so, I think that'll poison bilateral relations for some years to come. But with regard to solidarity, it was very curious. On this side of the Atlantic, you had people who were in solidarity with Mugabe, but were in favor of pushing out Mbeki because supposedly he was too much in solidarity with Mugabe. Now, there are all sorts of contradictions like that with regard to solidarity that perhaps we can get into. And in any case, I should mention that one of the problems in ZANU-PF, the ruling party, was so factionalized. There were so many factions. That was one of the problems in terms of drawing up a succession plan, which has led to this present crisis. And part of that factionalism comes from the fact that there were basically two liberation movements during the liberation struggle, 1965 to 1980, the ZANU Party, embodied by Robert Mugabe, and the Zimbabwe African People's Union, which was embodied by the now deceased Joshua Nkomo. ZANU, Zimbabwe ran afoul of Cold War tensions. That is to say, ZANU was supported by China at a time that it was taking a very strident anti-Soviet line in concert with the United States of America. And ZAPU was supported by Moscow, as was the ANC. And so when you hear these commentators talk about this long-time relationship between the ANC and ZANU-PF, they really don't have their facts straight. But what's interesting about that is that on this side of the Atlantic, there was a good deal of support by ZANU, particularly because it was perceived as not being in the Soviet camp. And that's not only on the part of the U.S. ruling elite, which at a certain point, as I say in my book, came to see the ZANU ascension as the least bad option, and also in terms of the solidarity movement, particularly in our community, the progressive community, the black community, which was very uncomfortable in being grouped with this pro-Moscow groupings that made them feel uncomfortable, which is, in a sense, understandable for various reasons. And so they, too, tended to welcome ZANU on that ground. But the problem was, once the Soviet Union collapsed, the feasibility and the utility of having these pro-China leaders also tended to collapse as well. And then when Mr. Mugabe engaged in land reform, which to me was the key issue, the North Atlantic powers turned on him with a vengeance. The solidarity movement was not sufficiently sophisticated to realize that that was the trigger leading to the turning on Mugabe. And so many in the solidarity movement turned against him as well. And as it was done with Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, the whole struggle was personalized. And so when you get rid of Mugabe, supposedly all the problems are supposed to disappear now, when actually you had an inter-party dispute Which brings me to the next point, which is the question of lingo or nomenclature, to be more formal. People who were once called U.S. Negroes were very keen to interpret misnaming. If you look at our current political situation, you see that white supremacists don't like to be called white supremacists. Look at Jamel Smith of ESPN, who got the hot water for calling the 45th president what he is, which is a white supremacist. So it's very interesting that those who executed this coup did not want to call it a coup. And that was a very sophisticated legal strategy because it stayed the hand of the African Union, which frowns on coups. It stayed the hand of the neighbors, the Southern African Development Community, which disapproves of coups as well. And so this was sort of a coup of a new type, because what happened once the smoke clears, you'll see, is that the military, they continued to address Mr. Mugabe as president, commander-in-chief, but they went after those surrounding him with a vengeance, particularly a head of security, the head of the police, various ministers, et cetera. So that was a very interesting maneuver, I must say. Now, in terms of next steps, there's the ZANU Congress taking place on December 12th, where I assume Mr. Mnangagwa, his position as leader of the party, will be ratified. Supposedly, there will be elections that will take place in 2018. But I would say that the situation in Zimbabwe remains very fluid. And watching that speech on YouTube today, I was rather struck by the tight security around the leader. Now, perhaps I should not have been struck by that, but to me, I inferred from that the still tense situation in Zimbabwe, where the ruler of 37 years has just been deposed, and you have a new ruler who's now, in many ways, dancing on his grave.
Well, the last time we talked, this was an observation that I made about the reluctance of Mugabe and other senior leaders in Africa to just get out of the way. They've served their time. They should have cultivated a smooth transition that would have kept the country at peace. But I marvel just the same that, considering the situation under which Mugabe made his exit or was compelled to make an exit, we find the refreshing savior here being African culture, in a way, the reverence for age and the conduct of the people as a whole. Even though they wanted him to go, they gave him as much elastic as possible as a token of respect for his age and what he had accomplished, even though it deteriorated to the point where they wanted him to go. So I thought about the cultural reference here being a very key point in this, what you just said. It's a coup. It didn't look like a coup. It didn't sound like a coup, but it was a coup. The people were well aware of it. And just the same, they accorded him as graceful an exit as possible. Even President Xi Jinping talked about his respect for the way that Mugabe arrived at the decision to leave. Very diplomatic language, but also indicating that even though the situation is tumultuous, there is this factor playing a great role in keeping things kind of under control, if you know what I mean.
Well, many points. One, with regard to China, of course, China is a major investor in Zimbabwe along with South Africa. It's also curious that the leader of the military, General Chiwenga, had just spent time in China before he came back to execute this coup, that it was not a coup. And in fact, like a scene from a Hollywood movie, the police had been dispatched to arrest him as soon as he got off the plane. But apparently his soldiers had dressed up like baggage handlers and had infiltrated onto the airport runway and then took off their airport handler uniforms to reveal military outfits and then arrested the police and then whipped General Chiwenga away, from which point he then went to execute this coup that was not a coup. Secondly, I don't take seriously these internet rumors that China was witting with regard to this coup that was not a coup, even though General Chiwenga had just visited China. But for those who want to pursue this path, we'll crowdsource our investigation here, is that Grace Mugabe's first husband is a military man. After she got involved with Mr. Mugabe while she was still married, and certainly after their marriage, that's Mugabe marrying Grace in 1996, he was sent packing as a military attaché to China, where he's been ever since. And in fact, when his son and her son was getting married, he did not feel comfortable returning to the country. But in the last few weeks, he's been writing in the public press, expressing his discontent with Dr. Mugabe, to use her former title, Grace Mugabe, and which I should also mention parenthetically that that underscores another point, if just to digress from this, which is that despite what you hear about Zimbabwe, it has a vibrant opposition press. It has opposition represented the parliament. You have Swaziland right in South Africa's backyard, which is an absolute monarchy, doesn't allow opposition, not to mention other African countries like Equatorial Guinea, where Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made a fortune. I mean, the list is long. So the younger person may infer from that state of affairs that when you have a European settler community, the standards raise. And, you know, you're not allowed to do things that happen in other African countries. Now, back to this first husband, I think that people may want to investigate that particular angle if they're trying to unravel what is going on in Zimbabwe. Second of all, with regard to these demonstrations in Harare, which is where the U.S. media, which has just parachuted in to Zimbabwe with their pre-cooked narratives about Africa and Zimbabwe, that has historically been a seat of opposition to Mr. Mugabe, although two-thirds of the population live in the countryside. And according to certain press reports, as late last week, many people in the countryside didn't even know what was going on with regard to this coup that it was not a coup. And so it'll be interesting to see what the reaction will be there. Thirdly, with regard to African culture, I would say Zimbabwean culture or Zimbabwean African culture. That is to say, as noted, it's a highly literate population. It's a population that also respects legalisms. I mean, that's what helps to determine this coup not being a coup. That is to say, trying to observe constitutional norms. I was just listening to Ibo Madaza, who is a well-known Zimbabwean intellectual. You can find this on YouTube as well. And I should also say he's the publisher of my book that I mentioned a few moments ago. He was saying that under the Constitution, it's going to be difficult for Mnangagwa to claim the presidency and that there might be lawsuits arising from that. So that's another point to watch. And then the question of economics, it's not only that a la Egypt, the generals have significant investments in mining in particular, and also in the farms. And that's going to be interesting to see as well, because some of them were beneficiaries of the expropriation of the land from the European farmers, who, after all, many of those farmers only began to get that land post-1945. That is to say, their roots in the country were very shallow. And there was a concern that a new broom sweeps clean, and that if Dr. Grace Mugabe took over as head of state, then their economic interests might be in peril. And that leads us to the final point, which is that part of the problem in Africa is in general, and I would say many developing countries, is that the imperialist countries control the commanding heights of the economy. And so what that means is that everybody else is left to scramble for the state sector, for control of the government. And certainly that's part of the story in Zimbabwe.
So in the immediate aftermath of this coup that was not a coup, where do you expect President Mugabe will position himself. He has obviously come to terms that he is out, especially in the hearts of the people, that, you know, he's out. But do you expect him to go? I mean, do you expect him to make a graceful exit?
Well, you know, the title of my book is from the Barrel of a Gun. And that was the metaphor, that is to say, political power flows from the barrel of a gun. That is to say, when the European invasion began in the 1890s, they were able to take over because they had the guns, even though they were a distinct minority. The liberation war that unfolds beginning in the 1960s, the Africans by that time had gotten guns, so they were able to seize power. Now, with this latest crisis, the folks with the guns apparently are not supportive of Mr. Mugabe. And given the remarks today of the heir apparent, Mr. Mnangagwa, and his rather acid comments about Mr. Mugabe and those surrounding him, I would say that rather than talking about whether there will be a comeback for Mr. Mugabe, I think that that's unlikely at this point. I think that what we need to focus on is how we can avoid score settling and revenge seeking and having, I'll put this in neutral and impartial terms. That is to say, whether or not there's going to be a search for what will be termed the unjust enrichment of Mr. Mugabe and those around him, and an attempt to involve other countries in this effort, not unlike what happened to Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines after he was dislodged from power some decades ago. In some ways, that search still continues. So I think that with regard to Mr. Mugabe, that's probably going to be, I'm afraid to say, the focus of upcoming events.
I want to shift to the increasing militarism and positioning for war of this administration in Syria and in Africa, the expansion of a military presence in these two particular areas. But we're not really hearing very much of it in the United States. The media just it's like a shutdown. They're not reporting on the extensive expansion of U.S. military presence on the continent. We just had only a peep of it on October the 4th when U.S. so-called advisors, who really are troops, SWAT team type troops, an elite cadre of troops came under fire, and we had a really horrific result with four of the soldiers being killed, and one especially ringing at the heart because his death seemed to have been an execution, and we're getting reports now of other parts of his body being found and being returned to the United States. But even at that time, there was no public admission that the United States had such a large military presence in Africa, obviously preparing for any number of military engagements. What do you think is driving this expansion of military presence in Africa? Ostensibly, it is because the United States is fighting terrorism and sponsors of terrorism, and Africa is where it's at right now. What do you think?
Well, we were just talking about Zimbabwe and how during the Cold War period, what was driving and animating virtually every aspect of U.S. foreign policy was Moscow. Today, I would suggest to you that going forward, it will become evident that what's driving and animating every aspect of U.S. foreign policy is China, which is very curious because, as we know, the way that China got into the passing lane was 4 odd decades ago, cutting a deal with visiting President U.S. Richard M. Nixon, and in return for deepening its anti-Sovietism, there was massive inward direct foreign investment into China, creating this juggernaut, which bids fair to leave the United States in the dust. There was an interesting article in the New York Times a few days ago. I will point to two articles in the New York Times. One, talking about in terms of green energy, robotics, artificial intelligence, and quantum computing, the technologies of this century, that China in some ways is in the lead and that the U.S. future might be exporting raw materials, soybeans, petroleum, and perhaps even cardboard and waste paper, which is one of the major U.S. exports to China as we speak, which obviously does not bode well for the U.S. working class. The second article was about the warming and China-Japanese relations, which would be a game changer. That would be like Nixon's trip to China. If that happens, game over. Certainly start making sure that your grandchildren speak Chinese, that's for sure. But in any case, that brings us to Africa because, as listeners to this program know, and as those who are melanin-rich know, that what helped to propel the North Atlantic countries to the forefront was their plunder and exploitation of Africa. That's the import of Eric Williams' Capitalism and Slavery. That's the import of Walter Rodney's Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And if I may put myself in this illustrious company, that's the import of my book coming in January, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism. And so as Africa supplants the United States and the North Atlantic countries in terms of an economic partner, as China replaces the United States and North Atlantic countries as an economic partner with China, and I would say pay particular attention to what's going on in Ethiopia right now, which is coming to be one of China's main partners on the continent, this is sending a nervous apprehension throughout the Washington and London in particular. And I think that this helps to explain why, if you look at your New York Times today, you'll see the story about U.S. Pilots killing 100 Somalis. This was just in the last 24 to 48 hours, for example. You referenced the story about Niger, for example, which led to this flap about the 45th president being disrespectful to the widow of LaDavid Johnson, for example, the black American who was killed there and whose remains are still being uncovered. I'm sure you know about the U.S. base in Djibouti, which, of course, happens to abut Ethiopia, and about the spreading tentacles of AFRICOM, the African command on the continent. And if I may digress, although I think it's intimately connected, that ties in to this recent effort by the U.S. domestic police, or terrorists, if you like, the FBI, to focus on what they call black identity extremists. Very vague and nebulous term. Although, interestingly enough, I think some of our liberal friends might have opened the door to that attack by the FBI, where they're going to target these so-called black identity extremists. That is to say, weaken the black American solidarity movement, the black American movement in solidarity with Africa, among other things, and of course against police terror. Because, you know, if you listen to our liberal friends, the main problem right now is black identity politics, to use their term. And now the FBI, as ever, has taken a signal from some of our liberal friends and decided to weaponize that particular thesis. But in any case, I think that there is grave concern about China, grave concern about China's role in Africa and how that may suffocate the U.S. stranglehold and the North Atlantic power stranglehold on the continent, which has allowed them to become fat and happy. And I think that that helps to shed light on your insightful comment about this U.S. aggressive posture, this U.S. aggressive posture towards Africa.
Well, actually, it couldn't be more aggressive than it is now in Syria. It has decided that even though a military and strategic victory was scored in battling ISIS, the Pentagon has said it will remain in Syria despite the fact that Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, is objecting, and the world community of nations doesn't seem to be sympathetic to the fact that as the head of state, he is being forced to live with a hostile presence, and they are physically now in his country, ready at any time to implement the long-range program that they had, which was to depose him, get rid of him, and put in place somebody that they like and can control.
Well, you know, it's very curious. Let's keep a foot on the African continent before we move east to Syria. You might have seen the story just a few days ago from Libya, the subject of a notorious and infamous 2011 bombing attack by U.S. imperialism that led to the overthrow of Mr. Gaddafi and his execution on camera. A footnote, it's very curious that the human rights hustle, is what I call it, seems to work better in Africa than it does in, say, Venezuela or even Cuba. That is to say, demonizing the leader, Gaddafi, Mugabe, and they're the devil incarnate, and they must go by any means necessary. It even seems to work in liberal circles with regard to Africa in particular, something we need to think about. But in any case, you saw the story about Africans, sub-Saharan Africans as they're often called, being sold into slavery in Syria. As we speak, hardly a testament to the observance of human rights, yet that does not get that much attention, interestingly enough. And what it reminds me of is that the United States likes to do what I call sort of accidentally on purpose, working with religious fanatics and zealots to overthrow regimes and then walking away or perhaps even being drawn back in to fight those zealots and religious fanatics. That's the story of Libya, for example, where they work with these religious zealots and fanatics and dislodging Mr. Gaddafi, some of whom, of course, have been dragged across the Atlantic to stand trial in this country, some of whom, of course, are ruling their fiefdoms in North Africa, helping to create a human rights debacle with the selling of Africans into slavery, for example. That's the story of Afghanistan, where the United States shared a trench with Osama bin Laden before they had a falling out, manifested most dramatically on September 11, 2001. And now the United States is in its 16th to 17th year of a war in Afghanistan with no exit in sight. And then that brings us to Syria, where the United States was trying to execute the same policy. That is to say, accidentally on purpose, working with these religious zealots and fanatics backed by their ally, Saudi Arabia, and backed by their ally, Turkey, in order to dislodge Mr. al-Assad, and with the U.S. press playing its usual compliant role in downplaying the odious nature of this latest U.S. ally. But what happened, of course, is that Moscow intervened, which is one of the bills of indictment against Putin right now, is that he upset that neat little story. And then after Russia intervened on Mr. al-Assad's side, they were able to flip Turkey, and now Turkey is an uncertain NATO ally on the southeastern flank of Europe. You may have seen those recent meetings in Sochi in Russia between the foreign ministers of Iran, Turkey, and Russia in preparation for a meeting that presumably will involve the heads of state. As you know, relations between Turkey and the United States are at an all-time low. I mean, just as a footnote, since I know many of your listeners are interested in the so-called Russiagate scandal, you know that Special Counsel Robert Mueller, one of the lines of inquiry he's pursuing against former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, it's a story that appeared on the front page of the Wall Street Journal some months ago about Michael Flynn involved in conversations about kidnapping the Turkish opposition leader Fethullah Gulen and then returning him to Turkey for $15 million. Now, that's your national security advisor? You got journalists who are witting of this story?
Him and his, son. Him and his son are supposed to be partners in this kind of crime. But, you know, we also have to look at the beginnings of a very strong formation here to support Assad, with including Iran. So you have Russia and Iran, two very significant allies, both nuclear capable, insisting that the United States leave Syria. But the United States, under the guise of fighting ISIS, has already established a foothold. And I could only imagine that this could be where the war starts.
Well, let me say that, among other things, in lead stories, you get investment advice. Because the other part of this story is the boy prince in Saudi Arabia, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, who will probably be the next king, 32 years old, close friends with the boy prince of the United States, Jared Kushner. As a matter of fact, Jared Kushner has been meeting with him regularly. And, of course, you know about the story of 666 Fifth Avenue, the Kushner building, where a balloon payment is now due, and he's been flying all over planet Earth trying to get money so that his fortune doesn't crater. But in any case, MBS has invested heavily in terms of this war in Yemen, one of the major human rights debacles on planet Earth as we speak. He invested heavily in trying to change the situation in Lebanon. You know, the story about Prime Minister Hariri, who was a dual Saudi citizen, was apparently detained to put under house arrest by MBS after he flew into Saudi Arabia. As you know, in the Ritz Hotel in Riyadh, a number of billionaires and the Crown Prince's cousins are now under detention as he shakes them down for their fortunes, including Prince Awali bin Talal, who is a major investor in Twitter and Apple and Fox News and all the rest, worth about $18 billion. I think he'll be shy a few billion if he ever gets to leave that ritzy prison he's now incarcerated in. And then, of course, the Saudis invested heavily in backing religious zealots and fanatics in Syria. And that has also blown up in his face. The investment advice is that you may, if you're a cynical investor with no principles and scruples, you may want to start buying oil stocks right now, because I think that Saudi Arabia is headed for an iceberg, that it's a major oil producer. If it hits that iceberg, that'll probably hamper oil production. Keep in mind that most of the oil-producing regions are in regions that have a significant Shia population, that is to say, in terms of that Shia-Sunni split, with Iran being the headquarters, so to speak, of Shia Islam. And this could really upset the oil market, which means it could upset the entire global economy. And that's one more point to focus on when we talk about the increasingly erratic rule of Saudi Arabia, which is creating problems all over the world.
Well, it certainly is a very ominous development, because now Assad, I mean, this guy, he can't win. He's being so assailed constantly under the gun. And we have all these world organizations, the United Nations especially, NATO and others, basically saying, this is the time. We have given him enough time to just volunteer himself out of his country. And since he hasn't done it, we're coming to get it done. This is very, very, very scary, I think. Well, you know, as I'm watching the clock, and we have a zillion other things to talk about, but let's finish this session And I'll ask your indulgence to come back as soon as you could arrange it to finish up the list that I have. And I know you have your own list of things that you think you'd like to talk about. Let's take a view of Trump's famous Asia trip. And all that, this fantastic trip that yielded so much. It was tremendous, he said. Do you agree with that?
No, in a word. But this also raises the question of lingo, which we mentioned a moment ago. The coup that was not a coup, the misnaming using the term U.S. Negroes. And now you have Trump with this new term that the press is sort of blindly going along with, Indo-Pacific, not Asia.
Indo-Pacific.
Now, why Indo-Pacific? The acute listener is asking. Well, this ties into this encirclement strategy of China. Apparently, Mr. Trump, he's going to try to use a rope-a-dope against China. That is to say, he's going to batter President Xi Jinping with soothing words. Hey, you the man, President Xi. you're brilliant.
He's a very special man.
A very special man. You're not only the man, you're a very special man. Okay, that's on the one hand. And then on the other hand, there's an encirclement strategy. That is to say, knocking together an alliance of Japan, Australia, and India in particular. India is the key country, because unless India cooperates, there's no Indo-Pacific. And India, of course, has some bones to pick with China, going back at least to 1962, when under the shadow of the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, China chose that opportunity to wage war on India, and from India's point of view, helped to cede some of Indian territory. And that dispute actually bubbled to the surface again a few months ago. But Prime Minister Modi in New Delhi, he has his own problems. And it's unclear right now if he's going to cooperate. The fact that I mentioned a few moments ago that Japan, which is the other linchpin of this strategy, may also be waffling, is something to pay attention to. What's interesting about this whole scenario is that in some ways Russia's in the catbird seat, because Russia has good relations with China. It has good relations with India, going back to the Cold War, when India was probably its staunchest non-communist ally. It even has good relations with Japan. Prime Minister Abe is spending so much time with Putin, people are beginning to talk, in fact. And so that only leaves Australia, which is a joke, a small country of 20 million, which is racked with all sorts of difficulty. Now, of course, going through the hysteria about alleged Chinese influence in Australian universities and media, buying up the economy, et cetera. So that's why I was suggesting a few moments ago that the scenario for U.S. imperialism right now does not look very good. But as you know, it has not looked very good for a number of years, and the United States imperialism has been able to pull its chestnuts out of the fire. Perhaps it could do it again, but if I were pushed into a corner, I would say no. This looks like Robert Mugabe as of November 19th.
But, there was a lot of pomp and circumstance and lots of parades and people smartly dressed and big dinners. But in the end, Trump boarded his plane out of there, leaving with nothing new.
Yeah, they threw some chump change at him, which may not even amount to chump change. I mean, I'm speaking of this alleged $250 billion in trade deals that were negotiated.
But that was in the works anyway.
Yeah, it was in the works, and probably most of the deals won't materialize anyway. And in any case, these U.S. corporations have lots of problems. I'm sure you're following what's happening with GE, the former General Electric.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, more investment advice. Dump your GE stock because this company is in real trouble. I would even say dump your Boeing stock, even though Boeing was one of the major beneficiaries of this China trip. Because Airbus, the European conglomerate, is breathing down its neck and has made some very smart deals right now that is pushing Boeing into the corner. That's one of the reasons why I'm increasingly tending to short U.S. imperialism, as the Wall Street lingo argues. That is to say, betting that it will decline.
And finally, on my list, I wanted you to touch on the situation with Puerto Rico. This is a real embarrassment, and it harkens back to the old super imperialist colonialist era in which the people are suffering as the entire island is about to be chopped up and divided among very well-situated and connected interests, real estate, banking, etc.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, and I would add to that gloomy scenario what's happening in what is called the U.S. Virgin Islands, where you have a similar crisis, albeit with a smaller population. But I just read a story the other day that suggested that there might, I find this hard to believe, that there are 2,000 Puerto Ricans leaving for the U.S. mainland daily. I find that hard to believe. But in any case, it is true that people are streaming out of Puerto Rico on a regular basis. This could have consequences for presidential politics in the United States, particularly since many of them are coming to Florida, a historic swing state, and I doubt if they're going to be voting Republican in statewide and national elections. And so that could be a silver lining in an otherwise gloomy picture. And then you see the regular kind of profiteering and profiting on the misery of others in Puerto Rico. I'm sure you followed the story about the small Montana firm that was selected.
It says it's owed $85 million for the work it has already done, and they want the money now.
Yeah, I mean, it's disaster capitalism at its worst. And that's in many ways only the tip of the iceberg in terms of how the Puerto Rican people are being plundered. A few weeks ago, there was all this talk about trying to revise the Jones Act, which is a U.S. law, and that means that under U.S. colonial rules, I mean, it applies in Puerto Rico, which suggests that ships sailing into Puerto Rican ports, they have to be U.S. flagships or otherwise controlled by the Yankees, which obviously hampers diverse kinds of aid coming into this U.S. colony. Puerto Rico obviously is Exhibit A in terms of the disasters that are brought by U.S. colonialism and U.S. imperialism.
Well, we talked also yesterday at length about the situation with Haitians, as almost 60,000 Haitians are being targeted for repatriation, having, quote, outstayed their time under the terms of the Temporary Protected Status Act. And we said that while Trump is making great hay with this, of course, on a racist level, what is being ignored is the role of the Clintons. And, I mean, we discussed $10 billion that they had, and Bill Clinton was the person, the point person to rebuild, and even bigger and better, he said. But nothing has been done. And the money has not been accounted for. We learned about the Red Cross getting $488 million to also build permanent housing back in Haiti, and only a few houses, fewer than 10, were built, and they have been described as glorified shacks. So we covered Haiti yesterday. In the short time that we have, what do you think about the likelihood that this would expose the criminal actions and the theft of funds under the guise that this was part of a philanthropic effort by the Clintons?
Well, your point is well taken, and I should also mention, since we don't have that much time remaining, there's a new documentary film, 1804, by Tariq Nasheed, about the impact and importation revolution. You may want to have him on your program, and certainly you may want to recommend this documentary to your listeners. But when you mentioned this current crisis, it also reminds me that as we speak, in just across the border from San Diego, California, you have thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Haitians who had left the island and were trying to get into the United States. Now it does not look like they will be able to do so. But once again, like Puerto Ricans coming to Florida, what that's leading to is sort of a Haitian-Mexican population right across the border from San Diego, because they're sort of integrating themselves into Mexican culture. And of course, since many of them are, since they're Haitians, that means that many of them already speak Spanish, given the proximity of the Dominican Republic to Haiti. It also reminds me of Mr. Trump's campaigning in South Florida, where he suggested
that I will be your champion, he said. Yes,
right.
Yes, yes. What a joke.
His, the championing in terms of ousting them from North America. So, you know, I hate to conclude on such a downbeat note, but this seems to be where we are.
Well, I want to thank you so much, as always. Incredibly insightful analysis of so many issues around the world that we ought to be paying attention to. But I especially appreciate the fact of your point of reference, which is exceedingly non-mainstream. And in many ways, you have actually had experiences in these countries that we have been talking about today, and therefore you see them, you see the situations developing from a particularly personal and professional and academic perspective. So thanks, Gerald. We covered quite a bit of ground, but I have a feeling that we should be talking again soon.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks a lot. Stay tuned. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. You could reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Have a good Thanksgiving, and we'll see each other Friday for Free Your Mind Friday. Bye-bye.